The fight for the future of digital music saw some serious developments this past year. Consumer attitudes and behaviors have shifted, once again shaking the foundations of the music industry and the legal profession. The prime mover behind all of this seismic activity might surprise you, though. It's not an all-powerful peer-to-peer network, nor is it a hack-proof DRM system. It's a gadget. A slim, white, modest, yet elegantly designed gadget. The iPod. I'm Mary Bridges, and today, Audio Berkman is going to take a hard look at Apple's portable MP3 player and the role this gadget is playing in the fight for the future of digital media. First, it's important to define what we mean when we say gadget. For many people, the word is a pejorative, a cheap piece of consumer electronics with a short shelf life and an even shorter claim to our attention spans. However, the technology boom and the globalized supply chains of the 1990s have ushered in a new class of gadgets, gadgets that are marvels of technology and sociology. The cell phone is perhaps the most famous member of this class. And the iPod? Does it make the grade as well? For technology journalist Scott Kirstner, the question to ask is,
do people actually use it? Does it find a place in their life? Or do they buy it or get it as a Christmas present and wind up just stashing it away in their closet?
As a technology journalist, Scott spent a good chunk of the past decade playing with gadgets. He has a simple criteria for separating the gadgets that clutter up our lives from the ones that are remaking them. Listen to him compare his iPod, a gadget he puts in the transformative class, and the PDA, a gadget he puts in, well, the closet.
I bought the PDA a little bit before the iPod, maybe a year or so before the iPod came out. But I just never got into the habit of using a PDA. I mean, I tried it for a few months. You know, I had all my contacts in it. I had a little to-do list in it. I had my calendar in it. But after a while, it just, you know, I stopped syncing it up with my computer. I stopped carrying it around. I don't think I could even find it right now. It's so far back in my closet. Under so many strata of other gadgets that I've bought. Whereas the iPod, I know exactly where it is right now. It's charged up. It's sitting in my car. That's usually where I listen to the iPod.
The car, the subway, the gym, the park, the grocery store, those white earbuds are sprouting up everywhere. And while there's always the risk of mistaking a fad for a mass movement, the iPod is much more than the gadget of the moment. The iPod has liberated the digital music discussion, which for the past 5 years has pretty much been confined to courtrooms, lecture halls, and conference auditoriums.
It's another example of how consumers armed with pieces of technology are breaking apart this gridlock and doing it in ways that are surprising many copyright holders, especially the people who run things like the music and movie business.
Mike McGuire, an analyst at Gartner G2, has been following the digital media battle since the beginning. He believes that the iPod has finally heralded in the new age of digital music. For Mike, the iPod is setting new standards, new attitudes and consumer expectations, and even more importantly, new behaviors.
Devices like the iPod are driving incredible changes. Not just that device, but that class of device showed people the real possibilities of what they could do with digital music.
Most of these real possibilities, however, are more often than not the very things the music industry has been fighting to keep out of consumers' hands for the past 5 years. Vast storage capabilities, song-a-second sharing speeds, file formats with easy-to-circumvent digital rights management. The iPod is setting down facts on the ground.
Well, at this point, you know, the MP3 format is the dominant music format. And that's just, you know, part of the world that we live in.
Kerry Sherman, President and Chief General Counsel for the RIAA.
That means that the way that you have to try and regain the market that we've lost is to offer legitimate alternatives that consumers are going to prefer. That's very difficult to do when you're competing with unprotected music that can be copied endlessly, that can be disseminated on the internet effortlessly, and that people can take for free.
When you listen to Kerry Sherman talk about the MP3, you can't help but notice the mournful tone. In 1999, he spearheaded the RIAA's offensive against the very first MP3 player, the Rio. The RIAA lost this fight, as well as their battle with file-sharing networks like Grokster. But Carrie Sherman has by no means given up. Earlier this year, the RIAA launched a wave of litigation aimed at individual MP3 downloaders. These lawsuits have garnered a lot of attention due to the young age of some of the defendants. But Sherman is a firm believer in the lawsuits. He views them as integral to the industry's efforts to reclaim what it lost to the MP3.
When you think about where we were a year ago, nobody even thought twice about using a file sharing system and downloading anything they wanted. Nobody thought about whether it was legal, whether it was right or wrong. And now there is such an awareness that this is illegal and can have consequences. It's a matter of popular culture now, and that is a very large step in the right direction in terms of getting consumers to think about legitimate alternatives instead of the illegal services.
We spoke to Carrie Sherman because we wanted to ask him if the iPod, and everything it has come to represent in the popular culture, was a factor in his decision to go with the lawsuits. Carrie Sherman's answer surprised us. It turns out he's a big fan of the iPod.
We think the iPod is great. The iPod itself is such a fabulous device that it is popularizing the notion of having one of these portable players, and it means that people are renewing their interest in music and in legal downloading to fill it up with great content.
Carrie Sherman, like almost everyone we talked to for this piece, links the iPod and Apple's iTunes Music Store together. This is something that a lot of people do. In fact, in the course of our investigation, we were often chided, at times even ridiculed, for even imagining that we could study the iPod as a gadget. Except for Fred Von Lohman, senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Fred didn't make fun of us.
Let's face reality. Each iPod sells for between $300 and $500. I guarantee you that every customer at the music store has not spent $300 to $500 on downloads. The iPod is what customers want. They're using it predominantly with music they already owned or acquired from other sources. And in fact, if you just take a look at the iPod, it sort of speaks for itself. You can get a 40-gigabyte iPod today. In order to fill that iPod with music from the music store, it would cost you $20,000 to fill that iPod with music from the music store. Does anyone think that the American consumer is spending $500 for an iPod and then $20,000 to fill it? That's not what's going on.
Listen to Fred, and you can't help but wonder where Carrie Sherman gets his enthusiasm for the iPod, or iTunes for that matter.
Today we've seen the iTunes Music Store sort of hailed as the future of digital music, the solution to all of the fighting that we've seen since Napster. Of course, when you actually look at iTunes, that's really an unfounded set of conclusions. iTunes still probably has fewer than 1 million customers. The total number of files that they've sold is still far from being able to break even in terms of paying for the investment Apple has made. And overall, the amount of money that iTunes has made for the record industry is so small that it's rounding error in their annual accounting. They've not bothered to even declare the revenues they've made from the authorized music services, including iTunes.
However, there are some people who believe that this nitpicking misses the point. Dr. Urs Gasser, a fellow here at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, stresses that it is important to look beyond the numbers. He argues that dismissing iTunes just because of insignificant revenues oversimplifies the issue.
If you look at it from the business perspective and revenue perspective, you're completely right. But please note, even Apple executives said in interviews that the digital lifestyle idea is important to sell the device, the computer, and the iPod itself. So iTunes and iPod, that's really symbiotic. You can't separate that.
Apple's concept of the digital lifestyle revolves around software applications like iPhoto, iMovie, and iTunes. They allow Apple's consumers to freely manipulate and move around their media ones and zeros. It is a powerful interplay of content, software, and hardware. But Dr. Gasser argues that it is through the hardware that Apple's digital lifestyle is expressing itself to the world.
Gadgets have become a kind of the clear expression of a particular lifestyle. So iPods is in a way a symbol for freedom, for fun, for mobility, for, you know, individual expression. So, and that shapes our expectations, what we expect to do in our everyday lives.
And as people start to expect these features and capabilities, markets are moving to meet them. This year's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas featured many new iPod-like devices and signs of future gadget-centric business strategies. Hewlett-Packard announced that it's developing an iPod in partnership with Apple, and Sony will soon be unleashing its first ever hard disk device as well. It remains to be seen if these new gadgets will come packaged with DRM that is as user-friendly and easy to circumvent as Apple's. And it remains to be seen how long the law will be satisfied with its backseat role. But it is clear that in the battle for digital music, the gadget has made the first move, and it is the gadget that is now setting the standard for the ways in which we will use and reuse creative content in the future. This program was produced by Benjamin Walker and myself for the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. Thanks to all our guests, and special thanks to John Palfrey and Charlie Nesson. I'm Mary Bridges for Audio Berkman. Thanks for listening.